From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Those of us who interview people for a living have a deep appreciation for how good Melissa Block is at it. When she was host of NPR's All Things Considered, she did thousands of interviews, and none of them are really easy in that format. Her colleague NPR's Howard Burka says there's something conveyed in her voice as much as her words. And she's always, he said, genuinely interested. And maybe that's it. She's interested. One of the last interviews she did with All Things Considered was with a Syrian refugee. And there's this moment when the man just sounds exhausted and really sad. Nothing really matters, he tells her in the interview. Nobody's listening. Well, I'm listening, she said. Melissa Block was in Utah in February, and we spoke with her in front of an audience at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. We're broadcasting that conversation today after the news.
This is John Shivik from Logan. I've been a sustainer for a year now. I've learned a lot since signing up. For example, I realized that, sure, Doug Fabrizio is a genius. He actually reads the books, watches the films, engages in conversations. But not like he's the only genius. Without the behind-the-scenes characters, those usually unheard on the airwaves, he'd be a guy on a street corner reaching out as far as his voice could carry. I had the pleasure of watching him at work in the studio once and realized how important the things were that Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark did. Do you know how much effort they put into injecting the right music at the right time? Screen calls, passing silent notes and emails back and forth to Doug while he's orchestrating an interview? On air, it sounds so seamless, doesn't it? That's because of who you don't hear. But it's not all them, either. There's another behind-the-scenes group, and it may be the most important one. Whose shoulders does the KUER staff stand on? The contributors, especially the sustainers. They couldn't do it without the powerful force behind the scenes that is us. So dial in right now and pledge to be a sustainer. Then, the next time someone brings up something that they heard on Radio West, turn to them and smugly say, I helped out with that. You couldn't have done it without me.
You can become part of the Radio West team by going online to KUER.org and making your donation. Thank you so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Melissa Block has been busy since she left her position as co-host of the program All Things Considered, which she did for 12 years. She's been working on a series about opioid addiction, and last month NPR sent her to Belgium to cover the two bombings there. Even when she was hosting ATC, she always managed to get out and report stories from the field. Because aside from being a terrific reporter, she's also a great listener, which we talked about when Melissa came to Utah a few weeks ago. We spoke in front of an audience at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City, and today in the program we're broadcasting that conversation. We began by talking about her hometown. Okay, I want to go kind of way back.
Okay.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Old Chatham, New York?
Old Chatham, New York. My hometown.
My hometown? Small town?
200 people.
Oh.
Yeah. On a good day.
On a good day. So I'm trying to get a sense of what it was like. Now, your parents owned a craft store.
That's right.
Did they make crafts?
My dad was a leather worker, so he made sandals and belts. On the side, it wasn't full-time. My mom's a painter, so it was partly crafts and partly art supplies, and I would help out at Christmas under duress.
Under duress. So what were you thinking in those days of doing? Like, what was the, like, expectation? What were you thinking?
You know, I don't think we talked about it. Probably what I was thinking is I'll go to New York and stay up late at parties and edit books and have this fabulous intellectual life. And instead, here I am in Washington having a terribly non-intellectual life, but a different kind. So I don't think I knew. And my parents had no clear path. I mean, my mom was a painter. My dad went to Oberlin and was a classical pianist. He toured with a flamenco dance troupe. I mean,
wow.
You know, there was no clear career path on either side
of
the family.
Wait, art and music, right?
Yeah.
Two things.
Yeah.
So you studied literature, French literature.
French, uh-huh.
You figured just something would happen, would
I guess,
come to you.
I guess. By the end of college, I think I thought I would go to law school.
Yeah.
Just by default.
I'm
offending everybody in the room. I'm offending lawyers now. I mean, what am I doing? But no, I applied to law school, and at that point I had...
You got in.
I got into law school, started working at NPR.
You got into Yale Law School.
I got into Yale Law School.
But you deferred.
I deferred.
And
correct.
Then you deferred. And then you deferred. Like, you could not. What was.
I couldn't. I was like, I don't know. Do I want to be a lawyer? I didn't know any happy lawyers. Again, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. But I didn't. And then I was doing this cool journalism thing that I had in the back of my mind thought I would do, but I hadn't thought about radio. But NPR was amazing and great. And I called Yale to defer one more time. And I remember the very nice woman said, you know, it sounds like you're very happy doing what you're doing. Maybe you don't need to go to law school. And I said, but I'll never do as well on the LSATs again. I just want to have the option. She said, I'm sorry. Your time is up. So here I am.
Is it true you applied to NPR on a whim? Just sort of, or had you heard about it?
No, I met someone who worked there. So I was looking at magazine jobs and met someone who worked at NPR whose job was setting up the interviews for Noah Adams on All Things Considered. Yeah. And he had just gotten a different job on Morning Edition and his job was open. And I asked what he did and he said, well, I pick up the phone and I call people. And I said, oh, I can do that. I mean, if that's all that it takes. So. And that's how it started, working for Noah, and no better teacher in learning the craft of radio and listening. I think he still is the gold standard for me in how he respects the people he talks to and how careful he is about how he approaches conversations.
Was there a moment when you figured, all right, I'm going to do this, I'm going to stay, I'm in with radio?
I think it came pretty early, just because it was so much fun.
Yeah.
It really is fun, and every day going in was different. And, you know, there were times that it was scary, picking up the phone. I can't believe I have to call this person, but I'm going to just do it. And you get over that, and then you're producing pieces, and you're going out and traveling. And I went up. One of the first thing I did with Noah was to go up for a ride in the Goodyear blimp. How cool is that? And here's the thing. You know how they look really steady? They're motoring along.
Yeah.
And they do. They actually are moving like this. And you know what they call it?
What?
Porpoising.
Porpoising.
Is that wonderful?
That really is.
I love that. So I think I was hooked at porpoising.
Yeah.
I think they had you know, that might have been the moment right there. But.
I saw on your Twitter feed, this is funny, because I'm trying to imagine, I want you to give people a sense of what it's like at NPR. And one of the things that I thought was kind of charming, you say Bob Boylan, who does All Songs Considered, you wrote, Bob Boylan pages everyone to stop and see the sunset. Happened last week, right?
It did. He'll pick up the phone and page over the whole building. Everybody put down what you're doing. There's an amazing sunset. And we have this beautiful new building with this great western exposure. And I swear, if the structural engineers had not designed the building better, we would be in trouble, because it's like lemmings. Everybody goes, you know, poor All Things Considered, it's in the middle of putting on a show, so they can't see it. But everybody else is just migrating and standing at the wall and taking pictures. But thank goodness we have somebody there who reminds us to look out the window, and there are some amazing sunsets. So,
yeah. I want to play a piece of tape. This is from your coverage of 9/11, September 11th. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that. You were a reporter in New York City at the time, and you were actually stuck in the subway as that story was developing at first. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so I was at home. I lived in Chelsea, and I was at home when I first heard on NPR that morning about the first plane hitting the Trade Center. And I remember calling an editor and saying, you know, it sounds like there's something at the Trade Center, probably, maybe nothing. Because at some point you're thinking, plane goes off course, coming down the Hudson River or something. Your mind doesn't go instantly, or mine didn't, to terrorist attack. I didn't have any of my gear at home, my recording equipment. Even though I was fairly close, I could have easily gotten downtown. Lesson number one, always have your gear. So I had to go to the bureau, which was all the way across town. By that point, the second plane had hit the other tower. And by the time I left the bureau, I think the plane had hit the Pentagon, so it was very clear what was going on. So I decided to take a train down the east side, figuring I could get down there and then walk across. But pretty soon they stopped all the trains. So I was underground. At some point, the train did move. I got out of the station and came up above ground and called my editor. And she said, I can't believe you got through. And I said, why? What's the big deal? And she said, well, both towers collapsed. I said, what are you talking about? I mean, what do you mean? And then I looked downtown. I had a straight shot downtown, and they were gone.
Yeah.
But I had no idea. And everybody who was underground had no idea until that moment.
So Howard And Berkus and I have been sort of talking a little bit this morning via email about you. Okay. Behind your back.
Slow news day, huh?
Yeah. Here's something he wrote. He says, it's a story that aired after everyone had already seen the most horrific images, the planes crashing, people jumping, the towers falling. Yet to me, Howard writes, it provided the most powerful scene of all, the anguish and desperation of searching for someone missing. Mm-hmm. No video, no images, just the sound of anguished voices. Howard says, it hit harder than anything for me. And Melissa had the ability to see it in the midst of that chaos, to capture it and to present it in a sensitive and compelling way. Here's a moment from Melissa Block's reporting.
I came across a lady. She doesn't even remember her name. She was just covered in blood. Her face is like all burnt from here. Arm all burnt. She was like half naked. I've never been in a combat situation, but this is about as close as you can ever get.
Late in the night, heavy equipment was moved onto the scene. Cranes, bulldozers, front-end loaders. Also, high-powered lights to help in the search effort. Firefighter Albert Kessner from Brooklyn described the scene, his eyes red and watery from a long day laboring in the acrid smoke.
All I can say is it's a war zone, and there's debris all over the place. Three stories high.
The two towers that once loomed 110 stories over the foot of Manhattan had pancaked to an unrecognizable heap. Firefighter Robbie Ricoy.
There's about four stories left of one of the trade centers. And that's all burned out. It's just a shell. The walkway going across the West Side Highway is probably about 15 feet off the ground now. That's done. It's unbelievable. You can't really explain it. You got to see it. There's nothing left.
What was it like reporting that day? I mean, was it just... And there's a piece of tape that I actually didn't pull from this moment. It was too anguishing almost to hear. Because so much of that. What was that like reporting sort of on the ground that day?
You know, it was surreal, really. I mean, that moment that I described of realizing the Twin Towers were gone.
Yeah.
I mean, who could imagine such a thing? And then working my way downtown and just basically talking to everybody I saw. I mean, they're describing what it looks like because you couldn't get onto, or I couldn't anyway, get onto the what they called the pile. To some extent, you put blinders on, and when something is so unfathomable, I mean, I couldn't anyway, really digest the impact of what had happened, but it becomes little pieces of a puzzle that you're putting together in the voices of the people that you meet. And the woman that you're talking about, I think, was a woman whose husband worked at the Trade Center, and she was looking for him, and she was going from hospital to hospital trying to find him. And I remember so clearly, and I remember the sound of her voice and the timbre of her voice catching. She said something like, what if he's still alive and I'm not there? What if he's in pain and I can't hold his hand? And I just thought, oh my God, I just couldn't. And that scene, of course, being repeated over and over again all across the city for a long time.
When you got the job to co-host All Things Considered, I mean, you continued to do field reporting, mm-hmm. go out. That was one thing that you've done a lot of course. But did you think you were giving something up by going now to D.C. and doing these interviews? And,
right.
I mean, do you know what I mean?
Well, it's a really different gig. And now I'm back more to much of what I had before, which is the freedom to go out and report as much as I want. What I was giving up was my free time. Because, as you know, it's a really constant onslaught of things that you need to digest. I was giving New York up, and I dearly love New York, as you could tell just from listening to those voices. New Yorkers are talkers, and they have amazing stories to tell. And I had free rein in New York to do all kinds of things. I mean, amazing news stories, but also just really, really fun features. I mean, I was in the Yankee locker room when they won the World Series. I mean, what is better than that? So I was giving that up, but hosting is an amazing thing. I mean, the range of stories that we can cover in a two-hour program, the access you have to people as NPR's profile has gotten raised and people respect what we do, it's an amazing opportunity. So I wouldn't trade either one. They're great in their own ways.
Did you ever Did you come to the job with a kind of philosophy about interviewing, or did you develop it?
I mean, I think you get more comfortable as you do it longer. I mean, I think overall my general approach is to, you know, I'm a guest in somebody's home. I want to be good company, but I don't want to be jumping up and down and attracting attention. I was just just reading an essay that John McPhee wrote in The New Yorker called Omission, all about what you leave out of writing, which is just beautiful, beautiful piece of writing. And there's a part, and I printed it out, and I put it above my desk. And it says, if you find yourself prancing around, I'm paraphrasing, if you find yourself prancing around between the subject and the reader, get lost. In other words, if it's all about you, leave that out. And that's basically my approach. I mean, I tend not to ask long questions. I feel like it's my job to guide a conversation, but basically to showcase the person that I'm talking to. But that's more how I approach it.
I want to play some more tape. This is an interview you did with Bill T. Jones, the choreographer and dancer. Some of you may know who he is. This was back in the winter of 2011 when this piece first aired. And you were talking about a winter song. It was one piece from the song cycle by Franz Schubert. And it's about this solitary traveler in this savage winter whose heart is frozen in grief. And Jones tells you that it was the arrangement of that song that conjured a memory.
Drüben hinterm Dorfe steht ein Leiermann.
For me, it's the musical arrangement underneath. It speaks about a bleak landscape. And this bleak landscape takes me back to a day when I was in fourth grade, out on the edge of town, looking out on a snow-covered highway, many, many yards away from my window. I should have been paying attention, but I was dreaming. And then I saw a lone figure walking across that on a very, very cold day. And you know how it is when the wind blows and you have to turn your back against the wind?
Oh, yeah.
And I felt so sorry for that person, and then I realized that person was my father.
So would you talk about that interview? Because I know you've mentioned it before, there's this kind of unfolding that happens in
this
conversation.
I'm so glad you've thought about that interview. It is one of my favorite interviews that I've ever done, and it was part of a series that we had done. We had done a series a couple of years before about summer songs, and listeners wrote in with memories of a particular song and what it evoked for them, and then this one was, very creatively, winter songs. And all I knew the piece of music he wanted to talk about, but I didn't know why he wanted to talk about it, and I'm so glad I didn't, because as he unfolded this story, it just kept adding layer and layer of meaning. And first of all, his voice is so extraordinary. It's just amazing to listen to him. And I remember distinctly looking through the glass at the control room at my producer and my editor, and every time he answered something, our jaws just collectively dropped lower, and we just could not believe the narrative that he was unspooling and the depth of feeling. And it was also, I felt like he was discovering something himself for the first time that he hadn't fully maybe realized. I mean, he certainly had that image in his head, and every time he plays that song, he thinks of his father. But as we talked more, it was like peeling back layers in a really interesting way.
We talked about his father, who had struggled to find work, took his family up to this place way up north. It was freezing cold. He was broke, as Bill tells you, and he was sick, and he had to get this factory job.
Yeah.
But the factory job is 10 miles away. Yeah. He doesn't have a car.
Right.
He walks every day.
Yeah.
He's a black man, and he's not getting a ride. Let me play another moment here, because you ask this question of him, and he gives you this really surprising answer.
I'm imagining that your impulse would have been to run out of that classroom and get your dad inside.
No, it was more complicated than that, because that was my job, to be in school. One of the reasons I was in school was so that I did not have to be out there with him. And that was the painful thing about this sort of class climbing that we all in this country are subjected to. We're supposed to do better than our parents. And did I want the whole class to say, look out there, there's my father, impoverished, freezing, walking by the road. It was a very strange moment, Melissa, very strange. I was, in a way, paralyzed, doing what I should do and not knowing what I wanted to do.
Keiner mag ihn hören, keiner sieht ihn an.
Such a beautiful moment, and I think he's catching himself by surprise, too, in the way he's thinking about it in some ways. There's so many things in that interview. There's this moment where he talks about how there was something beautiful and yet painful about that scene.
Right.
And he says this, he says, and he thinks this is what Schubert was trying to suggest, that this is, life is beautiful, but life is also painful. And he said, that's what I want from art.
Yeah. And then I think it was that moment that we're just like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like, we don't even have to edit this. It's just
exactly.
Perfectly. Yeah.
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 I want to play one more moment here because what are you thinking you want to ask him at this point? Because you come up with a terrific question. Did you ever tell your father that you had seen him walking around
right,
the day?
Right. Well, don't you want to know that? I mean, yeah, because
yeah,
there's this incredible visual thing. He's watching his father struggling, and you can just picture that dark figure against the white snow and where did that go?
Yeah.
Did they talk about it?
But he tells you he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it leads to this question of whether or not he really did tell his father about that moment, but other things too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's play another moment.
Okay.
Listening to this again after all those years, you're taken right back to that classroom and that image on the frozen snow.
That has been... It's taken on a greater weight over the years. Because now more and more, my body speaks to the body that I saw from a child's distance from a parent. I understand him inside and even outside now. I'm not afraid of aging, but the idea of what is success in life, what is a life well spent. His dreams were behind him at that point. Where are my dreams now? I love him so much for getting out there that day with no car and really not talking to us about it, not complaining, just facing it alone. I love him so much, but did I ever tell him I loved him? Probably not.
I bet you showed him. I bet you did.
He liked me. He liked me. Yes, he did. And that's so important. So important.
Soll ich mit dir gehen? Willst du meine Lieder, deine Leier drehen?
You know, I really love that moment where you say, I bet you showed him.
Mm.
It was such a personal moment. It was kind of reassuring. And
yeah. Well, I felt bad for him, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it felt like there was a lot of burden on him as he was telling that story to
yeah.
me. That's what I felt.
Yeah.
And so painful. And he was being so open and so raw about a very difficult memory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a gift, right? When they tell you stories like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Melissa Block. She was co-host of NPR's All Things Considered for 12 years. She's now a special correspondent for NPR. She was in Utah this past February. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. NPR special correspondent Melissa Block was co-host of All Things Considered for some 12 years. In February, she was here in Utah, and we sat down with her in front of an audience at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Okay, I'm going to read part of the wedding announcement from the New York Times for you
and
your husband.
Just a little shift of gears here.
You guys know she's married to sports writer Stefan Fatsis, right?
Oh,
I love that. Some don't. Amazing writer and sports journalist, of course. Used to be in All Things Considered
right.
all the time. Terrific.
Talking about sports and the business of sports.
And the business of sports.
right.
Yeah, got that memorized. He also happens to be a competitive Scrabble player.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote a great book, right? Here's the announcement from the Times. Mr. Fatsis proposed last September over a four-hour, seven-course lunch at a busy Paris restaurant. As the couple finished dessert and lingered over tea, Mr. Fatsis pulled out a bag containing a pair of Scrabble racks and two sets of tiles, which he then arranged in alphabetical order before Ms. Block. Tears welling in her eyes, Ms. Block quickly unscrambled the letters and turned the racks around to face Mr. Fatsis. He then offered a more formal proposal, to which she nodded and cried out her approval.
Okay, can I just say something here? Let's just say that the New York Times, who called to fact-check the article, called my husband, then fiancé, and did not call me. So, tears were not welling in my eyes. And while I certainly did say yes, I was not calling, was it calling out my approval? Who wrote that?
Cried out
cried
her
out
approval.
My, even worse, cried out my approval. Come on. We were in a fancy restaurant. What was I going to do? Start, like, jumping up and down on the table? So,
do you play
just saying.
Do you play Scrabble?
I do.
With your husband?
I do play with my husband and my daughter. We have a
13-year-old
daughter.
She's really good,
too, right? She's, yeah. She competes. She kicks my butt.
Okay. I want to talk about your coverage of China.
Okay.
May 2008, and you go to Sichuan, China to do this prep piece for the Beijing Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
You had gone, done some coverage, and then you came back
right to
Sichuan. And you had gone to, at this particular moment, you just landed the night before. Am I getting this right?
Right, uh-huh.
Yep. And you had gone to talk to, at this particular day, this pastor, this minister. Mm-hmm. So you're in this big building, lots of windows, and you had just sat down to do this interview when, as most of you know, this 7.9 earthquake mm-hmm. hits.
My position is to help my college or my pastors to pastor the church or to grow in the church, to plant the great church.
What's going on? The whole building is shaking. The whole building is shaking.
Oh
my goodness. Oh my goodness, we're in the middle of an earthquake?
Earthquake,
the
yeah.
The whole block is shaking.
Yeah.
Pieces, the top of the church is falling down. The ground is shaking underneath our feet and all of the people are running out in the street.
Yeah.
As we're standing here, birds are flying. The ground is undulating under my feet. The cross on the top of the church is waving wildly and bricks are falling off of the ceiling, falling off of the roof. People are huddled together here on the street. The ground is still waving. The shaking seems to be slowing down. You can still feel vibrations underneath. Everybody has run out on the street. There are crowds gathered. Somebody is naked.
Were you afraid?
I think I was too shocked to be afraid. I'd never been in an earthquake before,
yeah.
So it was more just bizarre.
Like what?
I mean, that
this is an earthquake that's happening right now that I'm
yeah.
feeling?
Yeah, I mean, so and almost similarly to how I was describing on 9/11, your mind doesn't instantly go there. So we were sitting in this building, and there's a big rumble. You heard the rumble start, and I thought, well, that must be a really big truck going by, right? Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. it gets louder, and you start thinking, well, maybe there's some kind of gas explosion. At this point, the pastor whom we were talking to, when the building started to shake, he bolted outside. And my producer, thanks. And my producer and I were tethered to each other by mic cables. I was holding a mic. She had the machine and the other mic. So she got up and starts running, and I'm being dragged along behind. And we run out into the street. And she's rolling the whole time. Bless her heart. She just kept rolling. And it wasn't a fear so much as just surreal strangeness. That is, I mean, anybody who's been in an earthquake can tell you that that is just a very bizarre sensation. And because, you know, I was describing, you know, bricks falling off and you can hear glass shattering, but it wasn't like buildings were collapsing around us. We were in a major city. By and large, that city was okay. and the damage, even though it was only, I think, 25 or 30 miles away where the epicenter was, that damage was extreme. We didn't know that yet.
Yeah.
So we didn't know enough to be afraid, I think.
But the reporter brain kind of kicks in right away?
It took a while. I think mostly we wanted to make sure our team was okay. We had a lot of people there,
yeah.
And because we were going to host the show from there. And once we sort of reconvened, and we were all fine, and I don't think we quite realized, because the city was mostly okay, we hadn't realized fully the extent. And then my producer, who was recording that, started calling for drivers. And once we figured out where the epicenter was and we headed up there, it became very clear very fast just how bad it was.
So, you head up there to the near the quake's epicenter. And this is a conversation, part of a conversation you have with Michelle Norris.
Michelle, I just left the G1 Middle School, which is near the city of Dujiangyan. It's about 50 miles from the epicenter. The middle school was pretty much completely destroyed in this earthquake today, and there are dozens and dozens of bodies of middle school children that have been brought out. They have been laid on the ground without any covering until parents can identify them. And when they identify them, understandably, the parents collapse in waves of grief. The bodies are then wrapped in shrouds and brought under plastic sheeting. It's raining here. It's the middle of the night. They're brought under plastic tarps, and the families have set up little altars. They're burning candles and lighting incense and burning paper money, and some are setting off firecrackers to usher their children in the afterlife and to ward off evil spirits.
I mean, you're obviously emotional.
Yeah.
How do you feel about getting emotional when you don't intend to, when you're supposed to be composed and you're supposed to be relieving?
Yeah, that was such an unusual case.
Yeah.
And certainly unlike anything I had done before or since. And it was just what happened. I mean, there was really no keeping that out of my voice. I have a daughter, and she was a little bit younger than those kids, and being confronted by death on that scale was just horrifying, and being exposed to that much grief from the parents, I mean, it can't not come out in your voice. I don't think there's any way that it couldn't.
Yeah. I mentioned in the introduction the Syrian refugee you talked to.
Mm-hmm.
This was in mid-August. And it's such an interesting story because it has this great little kind of coda to it. There was, in Iowa City, of all places, a choir group, the Iowa City West Choirs, and a man by the name of David Haas.
Mm-hmm.
He's driving around, and he happens to listen to this conversation you're having with this refugee.
Yeah.
I want to play a little moment from that because we can talk about it. Sufyan
al-Mubarak.
Uh-huh. You want to say something about this moment? I want to play just a little moment from this conversation.
From my conversation with him?
Yes.
I had been obsessed with talking to a refugee. I mean, it felt like we were just hearing all these stories about these masses of people, and I just wanted to talk to one. And a producer spent a long, long time trying to arrange this, finally found a worker in a camp on the island of Lesbos who had an iPhone and could record him in quality, and he just turned into this amazingly eloquent embodiment of what was going on. He was an executive. His wife was an executive. He said, we had a car. We had a good life. And he had left. He had left his wife and daughter behind because he thought it was too risky to bring them on the boat. He landed in this camp, horrible conditions. They'd had to walk, I think, like 40 miles to get from the shore to the camp. He's desperate to get out and go to Europe and try to create a life and get his family to him. But he was just so human. There was just something so human about him. And it's so interesting you mentioned that point when he says, nobody's listening. And I said, I'm listening. And I remember having a discussion with my editor and producer afterward about, I didn't think that should be in. I didn't think my part should be in. And they, because again, lead and get out of the way, right? You know, so take me out. But they wanted it in, and I decided it was fine to have it in. But there is that tension between how much of you leave in and how much you don't.
Yeah.
Were you thinking, as you sat on that coast of Greece, were you thinking about your wife and your child back home?
Exactly. Nothing else.
Do you have a cell phone? Could you call them?
Of course, directly I've called them. And we all started crying.
Tell me, Mr. Al-Mubarak, about the conditions at the camp where you are, where you're staying now on the island of Lesbos.
Actually, it is the worst condition I have ever seen in my life. The situation, for example, the toilets here, they don't have water inside the toilets. They are bringing waters within 1 hour or two.
Is there food?
I'm living on biscuits right now.
You're living on biscuits.
And bringing juice, and that's it.
Do you feel hopeful about what's to come?
Of course. Life must go on. We are all alive and kicking. But between time to time, I think of my family, and that's it. I just want to get them back to me as soon as possible.
Mr. Al-Mubarak, what do you think it's important for listeners here to understand about migrants like yourself who are making their way in these huge numbers flooding into Europe?
I want to say on behalf of the Syrian migrants that Syria is a good country. And I didn't like to go like this. It doesn't need to be like this, but this unbelievably deviled regime inside Syria, inside Iraq, inside every country made everybody eager to run away from this hell, from the Syrian hell, from the Middle East hell. I'm very sad. I'm about to cry.
I'm so sorry.
But nothing really matters. Actually, it's like crying for crying. Nobody's listening.
Well, I'm listening. You know what else I love about that? I just love that he says we're alive and kicking. Yeah. How cool is that? I mean, of all the English expressions that he would know, that one just makes me laugh every time I hear it. We're alive and kicking.
So he takes that interview, this choir director, and he uses it in the performance. You doing this interview with this refugee.
Right, some audio from the interview interspersed in this piece that they composed and performed, and it's really something.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. And I only found out about it because somebody, I don't know, sent it to me on Facebook or something in the way things happen. But it was, it's remarkable.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether he has heard it. You know?
Really?
I wonder. It's possible. He's on Facebook. So, I did a little update on him the other day. Were you going to talk about that?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I found him on Facebook, and I friended him, and I keep messaging him and saying, remember me? I talked to you when you were in the refugee camp. Really want to know how you're doing, or did your family make it? And he never heard anything back, and I would keep sending these messages, and I sent him a message on Gmail, and nothing, nothing, nothing. So I wrote an essay last week about this, but the odd thing was that every once in a while he would like a photograph that I'd posted on Facebook. And it was the most random, mundane thing. I had gone on a walk, and there was a yellow-bellied sapsucker up in a tree, and I took a picture of it, and he liked that. And there was a quince bush. We've had this crazy warm winter, and there was a quince bush that was blooming in January, and he liked that. And I made this incredible bolognese sauce, and there was a picture of it on my stove, and I posted that, and he liked it. And I just was thinking, this is so bizarre. I don't know anything about where he is, but he keeps sending me these little tiny pings telling me, I like that. So I did an essay and posted that on Facebook, and wouldn't you know, he wrote me, of course, in the way that these things happen. So I know that he is in Germany. His family is not with him. And that's sort of all I know. It's very tantalizing.
Yeah.
But he made it to Germany.
That's Melissa Block. She was co-host of NPR's All Things Considered for 12 years until this past August. These days, she's serving as a special correspondent for the network. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with NPR special correspondent Melissa Block. We recorded this in February at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City.
Let's talk about Roger Ebert. It's a great conversation you have with him. How long ago was this?
This was 2011. So not too long before he died.
Right. Yeah. And I think everyone knows the circumstances. Roger Ebert had a cancer that really disfigured his face and made him so he really couldn't speak anymore.
The surgeries, the multiple surgeries. So he had basically no jaw left. He had no bottom jaw. So he couldn't, and he couldn't speak, yeah.
Yeah. And he talks about, you talked to him a little bit about his blog, which he called A Venue of His Truths, and about his face. I want to play a moment from this. Would you talk about that? Because he's not afraid to show, although I'm sure he thought about it. But
right.
Would you talk about that?
Yeah, well, this was an unusual case, too, because he speaks by typing, and he spoke by typing, and he had a computerized voice called Alex who spoke what he had written.
Yeah.
Because of the physical constraints, this was one time when I had sent him my questions in advance, which ordinarily we wouldn't do, but this seemed to be a time when it was worth doing. So he had them, and he had typed up his answers, and then when I would ask him the question, he could play his answers. So there was a bit of a artifice going on there, but what can you do? And so you're hearing this computerized voice, and we were talking about, he wrote very honestly in that blog about the illness and about his infirmity and all of the complications that that brought, and I was really interested in exploring that with him.
His wife's there, too.
And his wife is there, too, yes, and she's a force in her own right.
Chaz. Yeah.
I was advised not to be photographed looking like this. Well, it's how I look, and there's nothing I can do about it. We spend too much time as a society denying illness. It's a fact of life.
Chaz, did you and Roger talk about that?
Yes, we did talk about it. He listened to people's advice, but he said, frankly, I don't give a damn. If someone wants to take a photograph of me looking like this and sell it to the tabloids, and then we came upon the idea, let's take our own photograph and put it out there right now. And he sat at the piano and had his photograph taken and said, the headline was from a Martin Scorsese movie, I'm not a pretty boy anymore. And after that, it was diffused.
Roger Ebert moves very slowly now, and one shoulder is much smaller than the other. His body, as he puts it, was plundered for bone and tissue, as surgeons tried multiple times to reconstruct his face.
The surgeries caused more damage than the cancer.
Doctors have proposed to you a fourth reconstructive surgery. You're shaking your head no. You have said no. Why is that? Why have you said enough?
I'm going to stop while I'm behind. This is the face I have. I accept it.
I love that moment.
Yeah, he was an amazing, amazing man. It was a real honor to spend some time with him in their beautiful house in Chicago.
Let's talk about the Rolling Stones.
Let's please talk about the Rolling Stones.
So sometimes interviews work and sometimes they don't.
Yeah. Except for all of yours.
What was the setup? I mean, I guess they were promoting something and you thought, I'm a Rolling Stones fan. I will take the opportunity.
Yeah. So one of our producers, our director, Monica Evstatieva, came to me and she said, do you want to talk to the Rolling Stones? And I'm like, well, yeah. But so they had a 50th anniversary something coming out, and we didn't want to do that particularly. But she had this idea that what if we could get each of them separately to talk about one song that they had done? You can tell this one song thing is that's a theme in my work. And they said yes, amazingly, which I was not prepared for. So, okay, great. And so we did them sequentially. They were all in New York, and they came in one by one, one after the other, to talk about a song. And they had told us in advance what song it would be, so we could listen to it as we went along. So Keith Richards was great. He was first, and then I think Ron Wood was second, and he was also surprisingly good. And then there was Charlie Watts, who I was really dying to talk to because he's an incredible musician, great jazz background. Of all of them, he's the most musician-y, I think, of the bunch.
Yeah.
Incredibly smart. And it was just a disaster from the get-go. It was just horrible. Horrible.
He picked Satisfaction, I guess.
He had picked Satisfaction, although, well, I'm not sure how much of this we were going to play, but it became very clear he hadn't picked Satisfaction. The publicist right. had picked Satisfaction. Right. He was like, yeah. oh, I don't know, just go talk about Satisfaction. He didn't care. He was just doing what they told him to do.
I think that may be clear in this.
Yeah, story. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you remember as you were recording it thinking, this is a great song, this song is going to be huge?
No.
No?
No, never think things like that. Uh-huh.
It was the first number one single in the States, right?
I don't know, but it was quite a big record. I don't know if it was. I don't know. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm not very good. We need Bill Wyman for that sort of thing.
I read this, Charlie Watts, that originally the song was at a different tempo, and when you re-recorded it, you set a different pace. Is that right?
I don't remember that.
Uh-huh.
It's going well, this interview.
I have to say, it went on for so much longer than that. You're hearing the prime cuts of what was a really excruciatingly painful conversation, but at some point it just struck me, well, that's perfect for the song because it's exactly what the song is about. Yeah. So we're going to make a silk purse out of this somehow.
Well, I don't know if you noticed there. My producer, Ben, actually noticed that right as soon as at that particular moment the part of the song comes up where I tried and I tried and I tried.
Exactly.
Did you intend that?
I think I can't remember exactly how. I'm sure that was Monica just figuring out, oh, this is going to be cool.
Yeah.
This is going to be just right.
I want to ask you, come around to the idea of digital media now,
mm-hmm.
what the challenges you think it might be offering for radio, journalism, those kinds of things. It's interesting. One of the things you've talked about is, and I think this is a question we in public radio talk about a lot, and that is, what happens, is the model old? Like, all things considered, it's a whole.
Right.
Like it has an A segment and a B segment, and it works its way through.
Mm-hmm.
And most people sort of come and go, but it's a program, it's a thing. And now people are consuming differently,
right.
and they're kind of curating their own experience, so they can hear that, and they can go to NPR1 and hear this, but it's not necessarily connected. And it's something, it seems like that you wonder about,
yeah,
almost
I
kind
do.
Of worry about.
Well, I'm so old school about this. I mean, I started on a program, and that's been my life for the last 30 years, so 31. But who's counting? So I do think of things that way as sort of an organic whole, and that there may be some balance. Maybe there's one point of view and then there's an opposing point of view, or that things start out pretty heavy, but then they get lighter and more joyful toward the end. And that model is probably not the model that most people are thinking about right now. And that's hard for me to think, to accept. I completely get the value of other platforms and streaming and on demand and curated content. But it is troubling to me. And I guess part of what's troubling is, you know, in a show, you might be exposing people to things that they wouldn't ordinarily choose to listen to. And with curated content, are you just giving people what they already wanted to hear? And if that's an echo chamber, I think that's a problem. And I think for the younger folks in the audience, are there any younger folks in the audience? they may see that in a very, very different way. I mean, just like they're consuming music. I still like, you know, whole albums. I like sequences of songs. I hail from the Jurassic era. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. One of the things you said about that, you said, what about the things they don't know they want? What about serendipity?
Right, right. And how do you ingrain that in something? On the other hand, I suppose you could make the case that as more and more people hear about things, I mean, how many people knew about public radio before Serial who know about it now,
totally.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
It reached people in a whole different way. So there's that serendipity, too, of finding new audiences and bringing them in a new way. So I get that, and that's very exciting.
What do you consume? Like, what? Like, do you have podcasts?
Yeah, I'm just, I'm a late adapter to podcasts, so I'm starting. So I did just consume all of Serial season one and was amazed at how compelling it was and how compelling she is Because, I think the trouble with some of the podcasts that I found is that I just don't want to spend that much time with the people on them.
Right. Yeah, they're not they're not good storytellers.
Or it's just a lot of blather, you know? Yeah. There's a lot of chit-chat out there, and yeah. That's not what I'd be turning to it for, but Serial was incredible. So I'm starting to venture into the podcast world, and there's obviously a ton to choose from. What else do I consume? I mean, the basics, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker. And radio, it's a lot of NPR, obviously. Country music.
That's cool.
And more music, TV now. And the beauty of having a sabbatical is that I finally started watching television. So I spent a ridiculous amount of time binge-watching TV shows that I'd never seen before.
Right. Can you say what you're working on?
Yeah. Well, I'm working right now on some stories about opioid addiction. Because I'm drawn to such cheerful content, I guess. I have this fascination with stories about medicine and sickness, I guess. So I did a series about body donation, and I did a series of stories about a man with early-onset Alzheimer's disease. I don't know, these just intrigue me. And the opioid story is so huge and affects so many communities and has been obviously hugely covered, and I know you've done a lot of work on it here because the problem is... well, acute here as everywhere else. But I'm trying to find, the way I've sort of defined the new job is to be doing sort of profiles and character studies. So ideally what I want to do is find a community and spend time there and report it sort of from the inside out of how various people in a community are affected by it, not just the family and the addict, but everyone around them and in the community. So that's what I'm working on right now.
You feel optimistic? I mean, a lot of people feel... we all feel uncertain where mm-hmm. journalism is headed in this era. You know, attention spans and focus. And where are we going to end up? Do you feel optimistic?
I do, and apprehensive at the same time, I think. I feel optimistic because I see the young talent at NPR who just are amazing with what they can do and how creative they are and how broad their reach is and their expanse of what they're paying attention to. And I find that really invigorating.
It's Melissa Block, former co-host of All Things Considered, now special correspondent for NPR. She was in Utah this past February. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to KUER's Brian Albers, to Michael Havey and Lewis Downey. Video West is produced by Josh Weathers. Radio West, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.